by 1983, with producer and director credits under his belt that included Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, George Lucas was established as one of the most successful movers and shakers in Hollywood. But a decade earlier, he struggled to get a movie made, even for a budget of less than $1 million. However, with the vision and determination that any young director needs in spades, he finally saw his cherished project come to life, his second film, American Graffiti, a movie that centred around his two great passions as a teenager in the 1950s, cars and music. Stephen Benedict is with us this evening to have a look at the impact of this film. But it really was a film, Stephen, that almost never got made.
Nobody wanted to make it. I wouldn't say his mentor, but his great champion was Francis Ford Coppola. Coppola set up a studio in the late 1960s in San Francisco called Zoetrope. They had a deal with Warner Brothers. The first movie that out of the hatch from that deal was THX-1138, which was George Lucas's first film. It absolutely tanked at the box office, and Warner Brothers cancelled the contracts. And Coppola then said, look, George, you're a really, really talented filmmaker. Why don't you go off and make something with a lot of heart? And Lucas said, OK, I'll try that. So he went off and he decided to sit down and write a movie about his youth. And, you know, he turned 18 in 1962, and that is the year in which American Graffiti is set. And as you said, it's about his two great passions. His greatest passion, actually, as a young man, was motor car racing. He wanted to be a drag racer. In actual fact, he was racing, had yet to turn pro. But then in the summer of 1962, just before he graduated from college, just before he graduated from high school, he had a near fatal car crash. The car spun out of control, flipped, rolled and smashed into a tree. The only reason why he survived is because his safety belt broke. It snapped.
Wow.
He was recovering in hospital and he literally had an epiphany. He said, I'm going to stop drag racing. I'm going to go to college. And it was only in college at the age of 18 and 19 that he discovered cinema.
Let's have a listen to George Lucas talking about why he wanted to make this film.
I guess the anthropologist side of me never went away, and I was very interested in the whole innocence of the 50s, the mating rituals of the 50s, the uniquely American mating rituals of meeting the opposite sex in cars was very fascinating to me. I really liked this kind of lost ritual that had gone on in the United States between 1940 and basically the beginning of the 60s. And I saw the beginning of the 60s as a real transition in the culture because of the Vietnam War and all the things we were going through. I had always liked Fellini's film, I Vitelloni, which is kind of the same issue about growing up. And I wanted to make a movie about it.
That's George Lucas talking about the reasons that he wanted to make American Graffiti. Stephen Benedict looking at the 50-year-old film with us this evening. To what extent then, Stephen, is he telling his own story here?
To a large degree, yes. There's three principal male characters. Harrison Ford is the first introduction for a lot of audiences to Harrison Ford, but he didn't play the main character.
Yeah.
You can really split it between Ron Howard's character, Stevie, and then Richard Dreyfuss. And Lucas played...
Who were practically unknown at the time?
Nobodies.
Yeah.
So he split his personality or his story between those two guys. One of them is very, very much a button-down collar, stay-at-home guy, which is Ron Howard's character, and Richard Dreyfuss's character, who's supposed to go to college but won't.
Yeah.
And that's the whole dilemma that night. It's a graduating night, and he's been given a $2,000 check by the Grand Lodge of the local elders of the town, which is Modesto, California, which is where Lucas grew up, and he decides not to go. And all through the night, it's you've got to go. And I'm not spoiling the ending. He has to leave. He has to leave the story. He has to leave his hometown, which is, I'm not making too grandiose a statement upon this. It goes back to Joyce and Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, because that's what Lucas was doing. He's portraying himself as a young man. And as we know in Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, he has a great line, fly by these nets, he has to leave. And if you think about all the films that have been influenced by American Graffiti, I'm thinking about films like Booksmart and Superbad, even John Carney's great film Sing Street, the characters have to leave.
They have to go. Let's have a listen to that opening scene, which gives us a sense of the dilemma, in fact. Richard Dreyfuss as Kurt here, Ron Howard as Steve, Charles Martin Smith as Terry outside the diner, and Kurt is having doubts about the future that has been outlined for him.
Hey, what do you say, Kurt? Last night in town, you guys gonna have a little bash before you leave?
Moose had been looking for you all day. He got worried, thought you were trying to avoid him or something.
What is it? What do you got?
Oh, great.
That's $2,000, man. $2,000!
Mr. Jennings gave it to me to give to you. He says he's sorry it's so late, but it's the first scholarship the Moose Lodge has given out. And he says they're all very proud of you back at the Lodge.
Listen, I don't think I'm going to be going tomorrow.
Come on, what are you talking about?
Well, I was thinking I could wait a year, you know, go to City for a while.
You chicken thing.
Oh, wait a minute.
After all we went through to get accepted, we're finally getting out of this turkey town, and now you want to crawl back into your cell, right? You want to end up like John? You just can't stay 17 forever. You've got to get that through your head.
I just need some time.
Just need some time. Richard Jeffers as Kurt, and we also heard Ron Howard as Steve, Charles Martin Smith as Terry in the opening scene of American Graffiti, which is 50 years old this year. And it is quite, when you look at that cast, they were, as you say, practical unknowns at the time, as was Harrison Ford.
More of a carpenter.
Yeah, he was still a carpenter at that point in time. And shoestring budget, $700,000. Did it make a lot of money?
Oh, it made a fortune, Sean. It made $140 million at the American box office. And the funny thing is, the studio, firstly, didn't want to make it.
Yeah.
When they saw the final product, they said, this film is unreleasable. We can't even show it on television. It was only Francis Ford Coppola, who had earned over $1 million off the success of The Godfather at that time.
Yeah.
He produced it. He said in the screening, he berated the executives at Universal Studios. He says, you should be down on your knees worshipping and thanking this man for what he's made. And if you guys don't think it's a good picture, I'll cut you a check for $1 million to buy the movie back. And it was only then, at Coppola's passion, that they said, actually, we might be onto something here. And then they released it, and all of a sudden the audience proved it to be a hit. Yeah. The audience recognised its importance.
And now we'll come back to the cars in a minute and Harrison Ford, but there is another huge element to the music plays a huge part in it. But it also changed the way music was used and the business of music in films. Let's have a listen to a little mashup of some of the music that you'll hear within it.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10.
We're back up in the woods among the evergreens. There stood a log cabin made of earth and wood. Where lived a country boy named Johnny B.
You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die.
Rock and roll's been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died.
Don't you think the Beach Boys are boss?
Let's go surfing now. Everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me.
Yeah, Bill Haley, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, and then the Beach Boys with a little clip from the film in the midst of all of that. That's from American Graffiti. I mean, it was a jukebox in some ways for that change from the 50s into the 60s in terms of the music that's in there, Stephen.
Absolutely, and that's the way that George Lucas actually wrote the screenplay originally. He co-wrote it with two other writers at the end, but when he was writing the outline and the scenario for it, he chose specific songs to go with each scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, Martin Scorsese, when he's putting together Goodfellas, did the same thing. Quentin Tarantino does it all the time. Wes Anderson's the same. Edgar Wright's the same. But I think that we heard the best line in the whole movie there. Rock and roll's been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died.
Yeah.
And then the young girl, Carol, chimes in. Don't you think the Beach Boys are boss? Because that's the transition. Because she's only 3 years younger than John Miller in the car. And for her, Buddy Holly's old. Buddy Holly is dead. So, and the great thing also to remember is that the movie takes place smack in the middle of the Kennedy presidency. In June of 62, Kennedy's inauguration in January 61, his assassination in November 63. So this is the halcyon days. This is the beautiful golden age of Camelot. And doesn't get much better than this. And it's the transition, because we've also got to take into account, within, I think, 8 months of Kennedy's, within a short time, in 1964, the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan's show in February 64. So this phenomenal change is going through. And that's really what the story's all about, transitions.
Yeah, but there's another aspect to the use of music in the film, which is the business aspect of it. I mean, if you even played what we just played now, if you even played even just that amount of those songs, the film would have a budget that would go well above $700,000.
Yeah, I shudder to think. But the amazing thing is that the movie not only gives you samples, it gives you almost all of the songs, which is unheard of. But licensing music rights to movies was actually unheard of back in the 70s. Most of the revenue streams came from radio plays, record sales, or touring. So Lucas got it for a song. I think $90,000 was his music budget. The only person missing was Elvis Presley.
And was that a money decision?
I'm sure Colonel Parker had a little bit to say about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, that changed.
Enormously.
Did that affect the licensing laws around the use of music
in
films?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about, you know, amongst the most popular, most successful songs of all time, Stand By Me is a song that was actually used as a title for a film. And despite the fact that that movie, Stand By Me, being set in 1959, Stand By Me, the song, wasn't released until 1961 or 62. But nobody cares, right? So the thing is, I mean, if you think also about the way Levi's advertising in the 1980s picked up on the beautiful songs from the 50s and 60s, I remember buying my first pair of 501s because of those songs. It wasn't because of the commercial, it was the songs. I wanted to be like those kids in the 50s and 60s.
That's your thing, you wanted the song that your man had in the ad. That was why you bought the Levi's. I know people who did buy them for that reason. However, let us move swiftly on to the racing the cars aspect of things.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford here, I mean, even from this opening moment in his film career, he just has it on screen.
Yeah, because he played a little bit of a sultry character. Everyone else was young and innocent and optimistic, and he was the guy who'd been doing the circuit for far too long, cruising the strip around the town of Modesto. And, you know, that's what Lucas used to do himself. But as you were saying, the great thing about the music is that the way we hear the music in the film is the way the characters hear it, in the cars.
Yeah.
So music was mobile and it carried you from one point to another destination, and it carried you through your emotional journey. So it's like an emotional jukebox. That's what the movie really is.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip with John LaMatta's John and Mackenzie Phillips's car. She's the younger girl that we heard in the scene earlier on. And they're driving along in the car, and who comes along but Bob Falfa. How do we say his name?
LaFalfa. Yeah.
Harrison Ford, the character here.
Sorry if I scared you.
You're gonna have to do one hell of a lot more than that to scare me.
Yeah, but looking all over for you, man. Didn't nobody tell you I was looking for you?
Hey, I can't keep track of all you punks running around here backwards.
Hey, you're supposed to be the fast thing in the valley, man, but that can't be your car. It must be your mama's car. I'm sort of embarrassed to be this close to you.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised driving a field car.
Field car? What's field car?
Field car runs through the fields, drops cow shit all over the place to make the lettuce grow.
That's pretty good. Hey, I like the color of your car there, man. What's that supposed to be? Sort of a cross between piss yellow and puke green, ain't it?
Well, you call that a paint job, but it's pretty ugly. I bet you got to sneak up on the pumps just to get a little air in your tires.
Well, at least I don't have to pull over to the side just to let a funeral go by, man.
Oh, funny. You know what?
Your car's uglier than I am. That didn't come out right.
Of course, it didn't come out right. There we have John LaMatta as John, Mackenzie Phillips as Carol, and Harrison Ford in the other car in a scene from American Graffiti. What I was saying as that was playing, you got to think they're in the car now.
Yeah.
They're not in a railway, not on a train anymore. The car has become the mode of transport.
That's it. The train was the number one mode of transport in the early 20th century. Transitioned after World War II to the motor car. But the brilliant thing about this is the diner isn't your classical diner.
Yeah.
But it is it's shaped like a spaceship. And if you think about George Lucas's next film. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was actually part of the architectural design style of California in the 1940s and 50s, all because of the UFO sighting in 1947.
Yeah, so Close Encounters was yeah. on the way.
Yeah.
All right. So Stephen, thanks so much for that. That's Stephen Benedict speaking to us about American Graffiti, hugely successful, hugely influential George Lucas film. It turns 50, believe it or not, this year.